You know, at this time of political change and economic turmoil, there's a news story out of Arizona last week that didn't get as much attention as I think it might have at other times of society. I don't know how many of you saw this really awful story about an 8-year-old boy. Oh, great. These clickers arriving?
Yes.
Oh, great. Thank you. An 8-year-old boy in Arizona who was given a .22 rifle by his father and proceeded to kill his father and his father's friend, shooting both men multiple times so that he actually had to reload the rifle as part of doing this. And of course, the whole town, not just the family, but the whole town is really distressed by this. And I just want to show you, I don't know how many of you can read this, but the mom, Miss Bloomfield, described her son as a normal boy who played video games nonstop and doted on his dog. So this is the kind of story that at another time people would have jumped on. Okay, what sort of video games was he playing? Were they some of the first-person shooter games that we've seen before? This was a big topic around the time of Columbine, for example, when the Columbine killers were known to have been video game enthusiasts. And when you see not the kind of video games that we looked at in class a few weeks ago, but what some of the more aggressive, violent video games look like, you know, you can see why this poses why people are concerned about this. So we're going to have a look at one of the popular games from a company called Rockstar, creators of the Grand Theft Auto series that many of you have heard of. I don't know if you all heard of the Manhunt video game series as well. This is Manhunt 2, which was fairly recently released.
Legion, for we are many.
Project betrayed us, Danny. They ruined our lives.
Well, what are we gonna do?
We're gonna fight back. That's him. That's Pikmin. Danny, listen, it's a manhunt, and they won't stop until we're both dead.
Manhunt 2, coming Halloween for the Wii, PlayStation 2, and PSP system, rated M for mature.
So I think it's that kind of graphic violence, coupled with the sort of awful murder that we just read about last week in Arizona, that is the kind of instance, kind of episode that sort of periodically puts violence in media and its possible effect on kids back on the national agenda. And it, you know, has been periodically for quite a long time. So this week we're going to be talking about two challenges to the media pose to young people: the long-running debate about violence and the sort of more recent concern about sexual content sparked by music videos, like some of those you saw in section last week, by the kind of more permissive stuff that happens in cable television and in movies. So that sexual content discussion will be on Thursday in section. Today we're going to focus on this widespread concern about violence. Now, of course, violence has been a staple of children's experience for a lot longer than movies and television. If you think back to what's the first episode of death and dismemberment that you caught up close to, it was probably maybe Humpty Dumpty falling off a wall, right? And you couldn't put all the pieces back together again. Or if you think about the sort of tension and threatening atmosphere that a scary movie creates, can't do much better than Rockabye Baby, right? How that builds up to the suspense of the cradle falling. And in fact, a study was done, published in the British Archives of Medicine a couple of years ago, showing that children are in fact exposed to more episodes of violence probably in nursery rhymes than in almost any other medium. I haven't had a chance to conduct any research on that myself. But so it's a long-running thing, is my point. Certainly, those of us who are old enough to remember when comic books are really popular, or maybe some of you have experienced comic books, know that violence in comic books has been a continuing concern as well, the sort of pow, socko stuff in Batman and Superman. What you may not know is that that became so controversial in this country in the 1940s and early 1950s that there were congressional hearings about what are comic books doing to our children. And as a direct result of this attention from lawmakers, there was, you'll see now in many comic books, the sort of comics industry seal of approval, a sort of industry self-regulating agreement that was made to sort of tone down comic books a little bit. Then, of course, television violence became the sort of principal subject of discussion in the 50s and 60s as television, you know, we've seen spread throughout the country and as came into homes in a way that other media hadn't. But it's not just television either. Movies are certainly continuing, have a long history of delivering violence to young people. We looked, remember, at the Pain Fund studies a couple of weeks ago and saw those volumes on boys in the streets and juvenile delinquency and other things that were supposedly sparked by going to the movies. And that was in the 30s. As movies became in color and then violence became more graphic and sound effects became more powerful and special effects became more feasible, movies have just gotten more and more ability to reach out and really push violent behavior in people's faces. We've just seen video games. And as you know, the internet is not immune either. A number of you, I think, probably came across Michelle Ibarra's work last week when you were looking into cyberbullying. She's just published a study about violent content on the internet, by which she means she's looking at hate websites, you know, sites that preach hatred of various groups because of what they look like or how they behave, sites that feature satanic rituals, so-called snuff sites, which I haven't seen, and I hope none of you have, but where you actually see real people or real animals being hurt or killed, those kinds of sites. And then she did a national study and discovered through self-report, this is just a survey, but self-report is that 40% of kids between 10 and 14 had seen one or more of these kinds of violent sites on the web. And so at each of these media that we are considering in the course, there's plenty of violence on offer and plenty of concern in various parts of society as to what that violence might be doing to kids. So I think our issues for today, our sort of framing questions are, what is the nature of media violence? What do you see? What are kids, young people seeing when we talk about media violence? What might its effects be? What is the result of being exposed to violence in these different media? How general are those effects? How widespread are they among the population of young people? And so then concluding with what, if anything, are the challenges here? What should we be concerned about media violence and its impact on kids? And then if there's time, I'm also going to try to say a little bit about, or talk with you a little bit about fear, which is a somewhat different concept, fear and fright in the media. So those are our sort of framing questions. We do need a definition of violence, what we were talking about being portrayed to talk about media violence. So I'm going to just use a very, I think, a very standard one, which kind of puts violence at part of the severe end of a continuum of aggression. And what we're going to mean by violence is behavior can be physical or verbal, but it's got to be acted out, that is intended to do harm to somebody else or some other creature. So there's got to be an intention to do harm. There's got to be a belief on the part of the perpetrator that it will do harm. You know, you really got to mean it and hope that it accomplishes that goal. And you've got to have a belief that the victim doesn't want it, okay, that it's unwanted. So those three things will be sort of our criteria for violence. Now, at this point, the sort of standard move in having this discussion or wading into this subject would be to show, you know, a clips reel of violent stuff. And you'd see a lot of scenes, many of which you'd probably recognize, of people being shot, people being stabbed, people being pushed off cliffs, people being thrown out windows, people being eaten by sharks, people being disintegrated by aliens. You know, I mean, the list goes on of sort of all the physical behavior that you can call to mind that goes into media violence. But I thought rather than do that, we'd kind of come at it a couple of different ways. So first, do people have their clickers yet? Okay, the teaching fellows are going to hand out the clickers, and I'll tell you why in just a sec. What we want to do is look a little bit into sort of your exposure to media violence and maybe compare it to young people's. But we got to get calibrated first. Okay, we got to sort of make sure that you are a reasonably representative movie audience. So first, we're going to just look at some films that are of general appeal, like these, and if you would just use your clicker to sort of register whether you've seen these movies or not.
Just one.
No, you're all the ones you've seen. So if you've seen E.T., you'd push one, and Titanic two, and so on. You're welcome to vote, sir, if you want. It's a general audience thing. Okay. Everybody in on this? Everybody clicked? Okay. Going. Okay, here's the next set. So click on all these, you know, click for all these movies that you've seen. I think that's everybody in, right? Okay, going, and one more set of general calibration films here. Okay, great. And now now we're going to sort of enter the experimental phase. So we've got two more slides for you to react to right now. Tell me if you've seen these movies, or all of them that you have seen. I guess I should have had a nun slide. Probably would have been a good idea. I didn't think of that. All right, one more. Okay, everybody voted? Great. Now, first we're going to see how representative a movie audience you are. Oh, wow. Okay. Now, in case you're wondering, it's actually fascinating that there are people in this class who have not seen E.T. It's pretty hard to find people who haven't seen E.T., actually. In fact, it's a little bit hard to figure out how to construct a list like this, just to digress for 30 seconds. The movie industry is shameless about the fact that it's all about the money, okay? So unlike some of the other systems we've looked at, you know, with TV ratings that were measuring the percentage of the population that's seen it and so on, the only way that movies are rated is by how much they take in at the box office, okay? Which means that it's a problem because tickets get more expensive all the time, so movies can make, you know, take in more money today than they did 40 years ago just because tickets are more expensive. So you have to try to do an inflation calculation, which is people do in different ways. What I did is just to take the last 30 years of movies, top grossing domestically in the United States and also internationally, and sort of make my own list of the top 16, kind of merging those. And that's why I wanted to see how you guys stacked up as a representative movie audience. Let's see. Okay, so you mostly saw these movies. Again, these are the top 12 movies internationally and domestically for the last 30 years. So, you know, we would expect the range to be pretty high. And one more here. Oh, yeah. Wow. So Tom Hanks must be feeling really good right about now. So great. So I'm going to consider you to be a reasonably representative movie audience. You did well on that, okay? Now, let's see how you did on these other perhaps less well-known films. Oh, wow. Look at that. A lot of people seen Scary Movie. Here's.
But I have a question, Joe, because it says 21 responses, so this.
What I want to show you is that these five, except for these three and these two, except for Menace to Society, were part of a study that was just published 2 weeks ago from Dartmouth Medical School. It was really interesting. The folks at Dartmouth, Kyla Wirth and her colleagues, did the same thing I did. They went through all the sort of top-rated movies for the last, they just did the last 5 years, top 100 movies every year. So they had 500 movies on their list. And then they winnowed it through several filters to limit it to R-rated movies, and then to make sure they were really kind of zeroing in on movies that were more challenging to young people. They also used the UK, the United Kingdom rating system. So it had to be R and the equivalent of R in the United Kingdom. That got it down to about 120 movies, I think. And they looked at them all and had raters code them, do a content analysis, essentially, all right? And then they did a survey of young people 10 to 14, national survey, 6,500 participants, so it's pretty good, pretty robust. And they found that 40 to 50% of those young people, 10 to 14 in this national survey, had seen all of the six movies that we just looked at, all these movies that were, you know, in this residual list of highly violent films. So if you ask the question, if I'd showed you that reel, which I didn't show you, of stabbings and shootings and disintegrations and shark eating and all that other stuff, and then you said, well, yeah, but how much do young people see that stuff? The answer is apparently a lot, right, based on both box office results and this kind of content analysis from Dartmouth. So I ought to really show you that reel, and we ought to talk about media violence as it really looks like. But there's a problem, which is that I'm one of those people who's really sensitive to violence. I can't watch it. I can't even watch trailers for some of these movies, you know, the previews, because the way they're edited, the way the framing, the music, and so on, I know that something terrible is going to happen, and I start to feel sick even before I see it. So I'm sorry, for those of you who like to see that, that I can't show it because I can't watch it. So we're going to look at a different kind of sample clip. We're going to look at an example of cartoon violence, which actually I can manage to watch. and it is in fact relevant because cartoons were shown a lot on television in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s, and were one of the big subjects of concern in the first wave of distress about televised violence and its possible effect on kids. People were actually looking at cartoons like what we're going to see. So I'd like you to watch about 2 minutes of this cartoon, and what I'd like you to focus on is what are the sort of attributes of media violence that you see on display here that you also, you know, remember or recognize from other kinds of violent, more graphic sort of stuff that you've seen. Okay, so our goal, in other words, is to try to identify what are the sort of salient characteristics of violence as it's portrayed in the media. Does that make sense? Okay, so let's watch the cartoon.
Be very, very quiet. I'm hunting wabbits. Oh boy, wabbit wax.
Oh, Bugsy, Bugsy pal, there's a friend here to see ya. Survival of the fittest. And besides, it's fun.
Did someone knock? What's up, Doc?
Now I got you, you wabbit.
Say, Doc. Are you trying to get yourself in trouble with the law? This ain't rabbit hunting season.
It's not?
No, it's duck hunting season. That, sir, is an investigated fabrication. It's wabbit season.
Duck season.
Wabbit season.
Duck
season. Rabbit fever. Duck season. Rabbit fever. Rabbit season. Duck season. Rabbit season. I say it's duck season, and I say fire. Let's try that again. Okay, I'll start it this time. Right. Wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. Wabbit season. Duck season. Fire! Okay, this time you'll start it.
Whatever you say.
Wabbit. Duck! Fire! What's the matter? Everything's upside down. Strange. Can't make heads or tails of things.
Hey, you! Come back here!
So, it's cartoons like that, and as I mentioned, lots of cartoons playing on the early years of television that that really brought concerns about violence in the media and its possible effects on young people in particular really into the public debate. And let's remind ourselves just very quickly, why is that? Why might we worry? Because we've seen through social cognitive theory and some of the other effects mechanisms that we talked about, right, that what people see does actually have an effect probably on their behavior or their attitudes, that maybe media like this might teach violence. That's one theory. Another theory might be that, or another hypothesis, I should say, might be that at least might teach desensitization to violence, that you might not feel it or care about it as much if you see lots of this. Or another hypothesis might be that your fear of the world, remember the mean world syndrome that we talked about with cultivation, that you might just see the world as a scarier, more violent place if you see a lot of this. So there are a lot of different hypotheses about why we should worry. But the worry has been very profound for about 50 years. I just want to share real quickly three sort of what I call flashpoints, benchmarks of this expression of concern. One goes back to congressional hearings in the 1950s. When things like what we just looked at were starting to come into people's homes on television. And those, unlike the comic book example I gave, these hearings didn't really result in any action. It was just a lot of focus of concern. A second flashpoint is a volume I've mentioned before when we first talked about children's television. This multi-volume study, Television and Social Behavior, published in 1972, with some of the country's greatest psychologists and sociologists contributing many studies about television's effect, and a lot of them about violence, concerns about violence. And then I think most interestingly, the National Television Violence Study that was conducted in these years and published in 98. And I want to just talk about that for a minute because it's really remarkable undertaking that isn't as widely known as one might think. A group of psychologists and sociologists joined with executives from the television industry, both broadcast and cable, producers and corporate folks, to make a national television council. And they looked at 3,000 programs a year for 3 years, monitoring it for violence. Doing content analyses. They had a staff of 250 people for 3 full years looking at television broadcasts to look for violence. How could that be possible? There's only one way it could be possible, because the public was so concerned about what this violence might imply for society and for young people in particular. You can't get the money and mount that kind of effort without a lot of political and social pressure behind you. And so this was a really major undertaking. I'm going to share some of the results from that with you in just a minute. I want to just preview kind of how I want to do this, because I'm going to try to move through some findings, if you will, pretty quickly so we can get to a discussion after our break. So I just want to sort of preview that we're going to sort of look at media violence under these four headings. Prevalence or frequency, sort of the uses and gratifications scheme that we've talked about before, the research base for it, and then a summary of the psychological mechanisms by which it might do. And I'm going to sort of do all that in just about 10 or 15 minutes at the outside. We're a little bit behind because of all the technical setup stuff, but we'll get to the break not too much later than usual. Okay, so frequency, prevalence of media violence. This is where the National Television Violence Study results from the late 90s are particularly interesting. They found 60% of all these 3,000 television programs, I think that's 60% contained violence. And of course, they were doing a responsible content analysis, right? So they did have a definition and criteria and so on. And these volumes are actually, we bought them for the Guttman Library. So if anybody's really interested, you can look into the details of this. 6 violent acts per hour across all these programs. But more shockingly, the rates were higher in children's programs, both higher in terms of overall incidence and in this frequency measure. These particular results are from the first year of the 3-year study. You might think that after these results were announced that the scene would change a little bit, but in fact, the numbers are higher for the second and third years. These are just the most easy to access. In those shows, 70% of the people who were the perpetrators, like we saw with Elmer, go unpunished. Harms often not shown was the finding, just as we discussed. Long-term consequences, things like what's it like to live with an injury or something, is almost never shown. And then in particular, in children's programs, the consequences are avoided and humor is used. So these are the things that you observed already in the cartoon, were found consistently across all this programming in the National Television Violence Study. So I just want to say that the Parents Television Council, which is an advocacy group, continues to look at violent content in television programming. And here's the results for the family hour, that is the 7 to 8 p.m. time. And here it is for the 9 o'clock. And you can see that it's not going down. So what you see is there's a periodic concern with this, and sometimes a little bit of decline. But then violence just seems to come back, right? That seems to be the pattern in television. Okay. So that's the frequency point. As you read, I hope you had a chance to read the Bushman and Huseman chapter. You saw that violence against people as opposed to property crimes is the principal media content, even though that's not the way the crime statistics actually work. And you, I can't remember if they discussed it, but there are very few anti-violence messages. So that's sort of the prevalence analysis. Please remember that all these, I put all the PowerPoints online after the lecture so you don't have to try to write all this stuff down. Uses and gratifications. Are kids attracted to violent programming? Well, the answer is yes. And why might that be? You've certainly hit on most of them, so we'll just move right on. Now, just very quickly, I just want to remind you, I think that Bushman and Huseman chapter is really a pretty impressive, throwing your arm around a lot of research. You may have noticed that one of the meta-analyses that's referred to there, summarizing 217 studies, and that's just one meta-analysis. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of studies that have been done on the research on this. So I just want to remind you, just very briefly, that there are 4 kinds of evidence that Bushman and Huseman talk about. Laboratory experiments. Now, I'm hoping that nobody here has forgotten Bobo Doll, right? Right? Okay, good. So you remember the Bandura experiment. And you also remember we talked about sort of some of the limitations of that in terms of it being pretty artificial. It's in a Stanford lab, and you can only look at the effects immediately afterward when the kid goes into the playroom. So laboratory experiments are useful, but only a small piece of the evidence. There's also field experiments, more sort of naturalistic settings in which experiments can be conducted. We talked about a very famous one by Friedrich and Stein when we talked about pro-social programming. You remember they showed Mr. Rogers to a group of kids and observed that they became more cooperative and more altruistic and other things that Mr. Rogers, other values Mr. Rogers was communicating. But there was another part of that study that I don't think I mentioned, which is in another set of classrooms in parallel, Friedrich and Stein showed Superman, Batman, and some other sort of pretty active cartoons to kids. And that's what they called their sort of violence treatment. And they found that kids who had been exposed to those for 4 weeks for the next month afterward were more likely to get in fights and to be aggressive with one another and so on. So they found an aggression correlation. Now, you know, these are correlational studies. You can just say, well, we did this, and then we saw this. They appear to be associated clearly, but you know, can you say cause and effect? That's much harder with correlational studies. So we also want to look at cross-sectional field studies, where you go sort of take a moment in time in a real, genuine naturalistic setting, and try to sort of see if you can put the evidence together that way. A great example of one that was done just a few years ago in Minnesota. I think it was 300 third through fifth graders in public schools in Minneapolis. They had moms keep a diary of what the kids were watching on television. They had the kids rate one another on a scale of sort of who are the bad kids. You know, who are the kids who are cause trouble on the playgrounds, who get in fights, who act out in class, who you're sort of scared of, and so on. They did the content analysis of the mom's diaries, and they found that, lo and behold, the kids who watched the most violent programming, as reported by the moms, were the exact same kids who were reported by their peers to be, you know, most involved in playground fisticuffs and stuff like that. So that's an example of a sort of correlational field study at a moment in time. And then some longitudinal field studies, and I'm just going to spend one extra minute on these, because it's so amazing what these people do. And I'm actually showing the citations because these some of these were done by Huseman, whose work you read. He actually did this work. Looked at third graders, and then looked at them again as teens. Published this in 1972, and I want to make sure I say the numbers right, and found that there was indeed a highly significant relationship of the sort we just discussed a minute ago. That is, they looked at the viewing records as kids, and then the peer ratings of behavior, of aggression and violent behavior, and found they were highly correlated. So that's kind of replicating what we talked about a little bit, except longitudinally rather than at a moment in time. Is everybody with me on that? But here's the cool part. They went back to that same cohort at age 30, and of 420 kids in the original study, they found 409 of them. And any of you who's done any longitudinal follow-up research know what an astonishing capture rate that is to sort of keep up with the study. And now, because it's age 30, they can look not just at peer reports of sort of aggressive behavior, and so they can look at actual criminal behavior, which is what they did, and here's what they found. On the vertical axis is a sort of seriousness of criminal acts, and I don't remember the details of how those are rated, except that murder is at the top, as you might imagine, and sort of other sort of physical offenses scaled down this way. And then the colors show low, medium, and high amount of television viewing at age 8. And you see that high television viewing at age 8 is strongly correlated with an actual criminal record at age 30. So that's the kind of sort of documentary evidence, which is really pretty amazing, that you can get with these longitudinal studies. It's also interesting to see that the same pattern is true for girls, females, even though at a reduced rate. And when they did the study again more recently and found the female numbers were much higher, much closer to the male numbers, you know, speculating that, well, female role models are changing, there's more you see more violence by women in the media, and girls may feel that they're more permitted to do more kinds of aggressive behavior in society now, so maybe that's why it goes up. And then just so you don't think that it's just Huseman who sees this, since you've read by him, you know he's very sensitive to this issue, I just want to show you that here's another study, also longitudinal, looking at adolescence as a baseline, and then looking later in life. Same kind of thing. The more television you consume, the higher your aggression. Here it's even broken down into prior aggression and not, so you can look at personal history as well as media consumption. So four different kinds of studies finding sort of a consistent pattern here. And then the last thing, and then we'll take our break, is, okay, so how does this work? How does media violence do its whatever it's doing? Okay, because we haven't sort of reached our conclusion yet, but what are the kind of mechanisms that psychologists speculate are going on to make this happen? And I just kept this extremely clipped because I just don't want to throw too much more data at you. So I just summarized them as four kind of generally well recognized effects that scholars of media violence talk about. The so-called aggressor effect, which is the one we've been mainly talking about. You know, are you act mean? Are you behaving aggressively or violently? But also the victim effect. Are you fearful, mistrustful? Do you see the world as a mean place? Do you feel like you have to do a lot to protect yourself going out in the world? The bystander effect, which some of you talked about with Bugs, right? Just apathy, insensitivity to what might be happening to someone else in a violent or aggressive situation. And the appetite effect, that is maybe the more you see of this kind of stuff, the more you want to see it, or it builds a desire to at least consume it and maybe participate in it. So these are some of the mechanisms, the psychological mechanisms that people think about that maybe media violence doing its having its effects. So thank you for staying through a lot of talk. It's going to be your turn right after the break, because we want to sort of now unpack the case that we looked at. So let's take a 5-minute break and reassemble it just before 4:15, and we'll look at that.